All right, we're starting here on the bottom. I'm Membet, I'm with Bet by the two dots. The Gemara here is continuing to investigate the statements of Shmuel. We had done the first of those statements yesterday, Gufa Mar Shmuel Shutaf Ki Oreid Birshut Ami. The next statement of Shmuel was that Ashutafim Meidim Zeh Al Zeh, that the Shutafim have a right to testify for each other. Gemara asked the obvious question, Meidim Zeh Al Zeh, how can partners testify for each other? Amai, nogim be'edutan hein. Aren't they noge be'edut? They are partial in the case because they are partners. If anything happens to either party in the partnership, they're going to have to redivide the partnership. And therefore, by definition, you have a vested interest in having the property or whatever the asset of the partnership is remaining with your partner. Because if he loses that asset, then you're going to redivide the assets of the partnership and you're going to lose. So of course you're nogea be'edutan, and why should you be allowed to testify for your partner? What's the scenario here? Dichtavle, he wrote to him, din udvarim ein li asadezo. I am relinquishing any ownership in this field. The way that the Rabbeinu Gershom explains it is that they kol achad lechaverei. Each one wrote to his other party, the other shutaf. Din udvarim ein li asadezo shel chaverai. Even if he loses his portion, he has no claim against me. And if I lose my portion, I have no claim against him. They basically divided the partnership in such a way that whatever is going to happen is going to happen individually to the partners and won't affect the partnership as a whole. In essence, they're relinquishing their control in the other 50% of the partnership. Each of them own 50% of 100% of the partnership. Now they have divided, in a sense, the partnership up in a way which says that I'm relinquishing my control over that 50% and you're relinquishing your control over my 50%. Where it says, V'chikat of lo my havi. What does that do? Just because you write, Dinu dvarim in li asadeh zo, just because you write, I'm relinquishing my control, does that really help? V'atanyo, don't we have a braita, omer l'chaveiro? We spend time on this in Ketubot and Gitin, these languages that are not efficacious in your ability to remove your ownership, which include Dinin Dvarim, Ein Li Alsadezo, Ve'ein Li Esek Ba, V'yedai Misuleket Mehmeno, in all those languages which are a relinquishment of control, Lo Amar Klum. None of those languages work. Now, the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom explains is that the problem here, din udvarim ein li psadezeh, or v'yadai misuleket midinzu, and he says, dahaka kazina ditle. He says that we see that he does have control, he does have ownership over here. How can he make a declaration that goes against the facts in the case? The way that the Rabbeinu Gershom is learning is that the language implies a historical relationship, not something about the future, which is that what you're saying over here is, Dinu dvarim ein li asadezo, vein li esek ba. I have nothing to do with this field. I never was in control of this field. None of that is true. That's in the past. In the past you were in control. You did have ownership over here. So all these statements are false. The Rashbam over here points out that he thinks that that is completely incorrect. He says that Lashon Chachamim, throughout Shas, whenever you use language like this, of Dinu dvarim ein li asadezo, even though it's written in the past tense, its implications are a future statement, and that it has no bearing on the case that he's saying that it's in the past. He means for the future, I'm removing my ownership from this property. So that's not the failure over here, but rather the Rashbam claims that the failure over here is simply that this language is not successful at disgorging ownership. This language is successful at preventing rights from coming to you. If you have a right and you want to deny that right, you could do that through this language because it has yet to come into your possession. As long as it's yet to come into your possession, you could say, Yadai Misulaket Emenu, I don't want this right. Again, the example that I always give is the denying of a penalty in football. If you have a right because the other team did something wrong and then there's a penalty, you have the right, if it doesn't work, to deny the penalty, to reject that penalty. So it's over here. These languages work if you want to deny a right that is coming your way. For instance, you're going to inherit property in the future. You're going to inherit something in the future. You could say, I don't want to take possession of it. I don't want that right exercised on my behalf. But what you can't do is disgorge something that's already in your possession with this language. As the Baalei Tosafot point out, v'adayisu lekutu, man who works by an eved. By an eved kanani, you could say such a thing, and then he will take possession of himself. The reason for that is, when you say, I'm relinquishing, or I am removing my control from it, basically what you're doing is handing your control over to the item itself. So now when you're talking about an eved kanani, who can possess himself, who can do something with that, then it works. But when you're talking about karpo, you're talking about inanimate objects, and you're saying, I'm relinquishing control, I'm removing myself and handing it over to the field, you can't hand ownership to the field. You have to hand ownership to something else. Yes, you could make it hefker, but these languages probably wouldn't work for hefker as well. But just in this scenario, hefker is not going to be a solution to the problem because you need to get into possession of the other party. And simply claiming to relinquish control is not enough to remove the property from your possession, because these languages are subpar type of language for transference of ownership. Or the way that the Rashbam phrases it, Ein ze lashon matana l'chaviro, this is not a granting of a gift or transference of ownership to his friend. Elashon tfilahu, it's as if he's praying, Halavai sholi chelik bisadezu, that it's as if I'm saying, oh, I hope or I wish that I didn't have any possession of this property. There's no real language of transference that's embedded here. It's a language of hope and wishing that this were the case. So Gemara says, Tachamai Skinan, Shekano Miado, they made a kinyan. You're right, the language in of itself is not sufficient. But if they made a kinyan to substantiate the language, then it would work. And that's the chiddush here, according to the Rashbam. The chiddush here is that even though you're using subpar language, when we pair it with a kinyan, it is successful. You are able to use that language when you pair it with a kinyan, and to remove your ownership over here. So Kanami Ado, the Rashbam claims it was a case of Kinyan Sudar. So it wasn't a full-fledged Kinyan, it was a representative Kinyan. You did a Kinyan Sudar with this language, and that allows you to remove yourself, or relinquish your control in the other half of the property. Others say that Kanami Ado means literally that there was a full-fledged Kinyan that took place over here. That will overcome the problem, because now you really have removed yourself from the property of the other partner. You have relinquished whatever rights you have. You have now disengaged yourself from that property using subpar language that was backed up by a kinyan. That kinyan, together with the subpar language, allows you to do that. So in Okanami, you could have done a full-fledged kinyan and explained that you're giving over the property to the other party. Had you done that, it would have worked. The Chiddush, or what the Gemara is teaching you, is that you can do this with these subpar languages. If you pair it with the Kinyan, it works. It's successful. So yeah, right. If you did everything in the way it's supposed to be done and full-fledged Kinyanim with the proper languages, then of course it would work. The Gemara here is trying to teach us that even with this lesser type of language, you can still accomplish what we're trying to accomplish over here. V'chi kanu miyado mayavi. Okay. Now we made a Kinyan. Why does that help us over here? Because in the end, he can still use it to pay off his creditor. Remember that if he borrowed money prior to this relinquishment of control, or in essence, gifting whatever rights he has in the property to his partner, that means that you have a chronological order in which all of this took place. The lender of money to him, the creditor, has a lien on his property that precedes his gifting of the rights or the giving of the ownership to the other partner. Therefore, the creditor has a lien that he can exercise over here. Now, if a third party comes along and says, the property never belonged to you as partners, never belonged to your partner, he's going to lose out now because his creditor can't go after that property anymore. If the property remains in the hands of his partner, then his creditor has a way to get to that or access to that. And by getting access to that, he'll repay the loan. So he doesn't want to be a person who defaults on a loan. So he wants to have the property, or has a vested interest in the property being in the hands of his shutaf, because his shutaf's rights succeed the rights or the lien of the creditor, and therefore the creditor can come and take the property. If there is some other party, third party, claiming that they had rights that preceded everyone here, then he loses the property completely, and the creditor has nothing to go after anymore. He's going to default on the loan. Dama Ravin Bar Shmuel Mishmei de Shmuel Umocher Sadeh Chaviro Shelo Be'Achrayut. Someone who sells a field to his friend without recourse, you cannot testify to him on that behalf, because he can use that as collateral to pay back the creditor. Over here, where he sold the property without recourse, that means the buyer of the property has no rights to come complain if the property is taken away from him. So now he has a creditor that preceded this sale. That creditor has a lien on the property that precedes the ownership of the buyer. So this individual has a vested interest in seeing that property remain in the hands of the buyer, because then the creditor will have something to collect from. If he doesn't have cash to pay back the loan, the creditor will have a way to collect. So there is a negiut badavar. There is partiality in this case because of the fact that you have a vested interest in keeping the property local, in the sense, with the hands of this buyer, because his rights clearly came after the rights of the creditor. And therefore, if the creditor needs to collect, he'll get that property, and you won't default on your loan, or, in essence, you won't be, the way that the Rashbam explains it, based on the Gemara later on, lo rasha veinu mishalem, that you are a borrower who doesn't repay. Over here, you're clearly going to repay that which is due. The Baal Tosafot asks a question that comes up in the Gemara in other places, which is, the Gemara notes that even if you don't have achrayut, if you don't have responsibility, you have a right to enter into a case or enter a fray and say, I want to keep the property in the buyer's hands. And the person who's bringing up the questions or being me'arer on the ownership of this property can't say to you, you are not the baal davar. You are not the litigant here because you sold the property. You're no longer relevant to this case, because you can say, I don't want this guy to have bad feelings towards me. I don't want him to have a complaint against me. He may not have recourse to come and make a monetary claim against me, but in the end, if the property gets taken away from him, he's going to come back to me and say, you sold me a lemon. Why did you sell me this? I don't want to purchase from you anymore. I don't want to do business with you anymore. Given that, the person is considered to have a vested interest in the outcome of the case, even when there is no recourse, because he has a vested interest in seeing the property remain with the buyer. Even though he bears no monetary responsibility, there's still this intangible goodwill that if he keeps the property with his individual, then the sale was a good sale. If it gets taken away from him, he's going to always have this bad feeling towards him that he sold him property that was going to be confiscated. So given that, Tosafot says, why doesn't the Gemara just answer that, forget about it, it was with achrayut. Even without achrayut, you still have connection or vested interest in the case. So he gives two answers. Says that may not be enough to consider you to be partial in the case, even though there's this intangible idea of goodwill that you want to create. Maybe that's not sufficient to generate a what's called negi'a be'idut. You need monetary interest in order to have a real partiality in the case, and that you don't have here. Or Tosfot suggests inami yochemari afilu b'machir bashishalo. It's a case where the buyer knows for sure it belongs to the seller, and he's not going to complain to him. He knows that he's right here, and he's not going to go back to him and say, why'd you do this to me? Because he knows he's right. He knows that the person who sold it to him is right. So in that case, he has no taromet, and therefore he would not be considered no geba davar. So that's why Tosafot says that the Gemara jumped to the track of saying he would be willing to make sure that the property stays so that the creditor gets it, versus the case where if it remained in his hands, all it would do is protect him from issue of goodwill. That's not considered to be nogeya be'iduto, or he would not be considered to be pasul in that case. Now, the Gemara gives the answer, which is obvious, achamayiskinan dekabal alei achrayut. It's a case where he accepted responsibility, there was recourse. Because if there is recourse, then you are indifferent between whether the creditor takes the property or the property remains in the hands of the other party. Because in this case, you're going to have to pay somebody back. Either way, you're going to end up owing money, no matter whether the property goes to the creditor or whether the property stays in the hands of this buyer. Either way, you're going to be on the hook for repayment over here. Therefore, you're no longer considered to be nogeya be'iduto. You are not partial anymore in the case, because the outcome of the case you will be completely indifferent to. Whether the property remains here and the creditor takes it, and then you're going to have to repay this buyer because he had achrayut, or whether the property simply remains with this buyer. Either way, in that case, you're going to owe somebody money. And so therefore, you have no gain in whether it stays with the buyer or doesn't stay with the buyer in that case. So for that reason, you are no longer considered to be nogeya ve'eduto. So over here, we have the achrayut generating a level playing field by which he has no partiality in the case, because no matter what happens to the property, he's going to be on the hook for money. A and B have a partnership, and their partnership now, A wants to remove himself from any interest in B's property, because he wants to testify to the fact that B's property is his property, and he wants to do that, we said, because he does have a vested interest in that happening. As long as the property remains in B's control, then whatever he owned, A owned beforehand and gave over to B, his creditors, A's creditors, can now come and collect from B. So A has a vested interest in seeing the property stay with B, because his creditors then will go after that property. Gemara said, fine, it's a case where he had sold it, but he sold it without achrayut. That's right in that case, because there's no recourse. That means if B loses the property, then he gains by having the creditor be paid back, and B loses money, but A has no responsibility for that. The Gemara in the end says, no, A is responsible for B's losses now. And so if that's the case, then he is partial in this case, because he wants the property to remain with B, because then his creditor can come and get it. The creditor comes and gets it, he's going to lose money anyway, because then B is going to come back to him and say, you owe me money. So either way, you have to worry about the fact that he won't have to worry about him being partial in the case, because he's going to lose money no matter what. He's either going to owe money to the creditor, or he's going to owe money to B, with who he sold or gave over his rights in the property with recourse, with the ability to come back to him if it's lost or taken away, and demand payment from him. Now the Gemara does ask a question, achrayut daman. What type of responsibility does he have here? Inema achrayut da'alma. If he has general responsibility, kol shekein d'neichale. Wait a minute, now he is partial in the case. What are you talking about? There are different scenarios that can play out over here. One scenario is the property stays with B. The property stays with B, his partner that he gave over that ownership to. Then the creditor can come and take the property, and then he'll owe B money because of the recourse that he gave them the property with. But if they take away the property completely, and now it belongs to a third party, he actually is... No, someone else, a third party comes along and takes away the property. That's what we're testifying about here. We're testifying whether it belongs to B, his partner, or belongs to some third party who came along and claims that the property was his. Over there, he does have a vested interest, because the third party walks away with the property, he's actually going to owe two people money. He's going to owe his creditor money, and he's going to owe recourse to the partner. So he does have a huge vested interest in seeing the property remain with either the creditor or his partner. Either one of those, because then at least he only owns one person money. If it leaves them completely, now he owes two people money, and now he's really up the creek. So that can't be the situation in which he accepted recourse for. Ela achrayut atile machmate. He accepts responsibility for losses that derive from him directly. Which means that if the creditor comes and takes away the property from the partner, the reason for the loss in the property is his creditor. A's creditor is causing the loss to B, then A is responsible to replace it. That's what he says. I'll replace your property. If anybody comes because of me to take away your property, I guarantee you that I will replace it. If somebody comes from the outside and starts making a claim that you never owned the properties, then I'm not taking any responsibility, because that's a claim against the partnership as a whole. That's not a claim directed at me that's causing you a loss. That loss is a loss that was generated from or caused by something that has nothing to do with me in particular, that has to do with all of our ownership from the outset. So in that case, he will no longer be a nogeya, but davar, if he testifies to the fact that the property stays with B, then he's no better off than if the property leaves B. Because in that case, if it stays with B, then his creditor, A's creditor, will come along and take the property. Now he paid his creditor back. He owes B money now because A's creditor took away the property from B. So he owes him money. We're indifferent, as the Rashbam says, between a creditor that comes and takes and gets paid back and leaves you a new creditor, or whether the new creditor is satisfied and the old creditor you still owe money to. So in that case, you have no monetary benefit because you're just changing creditors. You're not changing the fact that you owe money. If the third party is successful at taking the property away completely, aren't you no gea badavra because then you're going to lose? No, the answer is not. In that case, you won't owe B any money. You'll only owe your creditor money because you didn't guarantee to B that you'd replace the property in that case. So in essence, you are indifferent in the outcome of the case. If the third party who's questioning ownership here wins, you'll owe your original creditor money. A will owe his original creditor money. If he wins the case and his partner gets to keep the property, creditor A will come and take that property away from his buddy B, and then he'll owe B the money to replace the property. So the question is, does he owe money to his original creditor, or does he owe money to his new creditor, the partner that he gave the property to with guarantees? He should be indifferent. He owes money. Should be indifferent between whether he owes money to this guy or that guy. Given that, he's no longer nogea ve'eduto. He's no longer partial in the case because the outcome will be he owes the money. Who he owes the money to will be the only difference, but he owes the money. In that case, he can testify on behalf of his partner to keep the property in the hands of his partner because of the fact that he gains nothing monetarily in this case. Gemara says, V'chi misalik nafshe minei mim misalik. Are you really successful in this case to be considered impartial? Because, as the Rashbam says, there could be a knunya. You could have collusion between you, which basically says you give it to B, saying that I granted all my ownership to B, wink, 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 and then you go and testify on behalf of B, and then after you're finished with that case, B hands it back to you. Your old partner hands it back to you and gives it back to you. So do you say that he's completely impartial? Or maybe there's some sort of collusion going on over here, and he really is no geya be'eduto. Where it says, Vatanya, we have a braita that shows that there is not impartiality when you remove yourself from a case. Ne'ir, shenignav sefer Torah shelahen. There were people of a city, members of the city, and the city's sefer Torah was stolen. We'll assume here that there was only one sefer Torah in the city. So this is their lone sefer Torah has now been stolen. Ein danin b'danei oto ayir. The judges in the case cannot be judges from this city. And the edim from in the case cannot be witnesses who saw the ganav steal it, cannot be witnesses from this city, because they are all nogeya badavar. The Sefer Torah is the one Sefer Torah in the city. They are all joint owners of this Sefer Torah, and therefore they're all considered to be partial in the case. The dayanim or the edim have an ownership right inside of this Sefer Torah. That ownership right in the Sefer Torah makes them partial in the case, and therefore they can't be either dayanim or edim in the case. If that's the case, why don't two people basically relinquish their ownership in the Sefer Torah to remaining members of the city? And either then they can become judges in the case, or more importantly, they become edim in the case, and they can testify that the ganav stole the Sefer Torah, because now they have removed their monetary interest in the Sefer Torah. So if you have an ability to remove your monetary ownership from a case, then you could do that here too. And the people will relinquish their control, thereby giving the city the back to Sefer Torah, because they can testify or adjudicate the case, because they have removed their partiality in the case. Shiny Sefer Torah, Dilishmi Akai. Sefer Torah is different. Because you have two interests in a Sefer Torah. You have a possibly ownership interest in a Sefer Torah. That you can remove. That you can relinquish. But there is another interest you have in a Sefer Torah. Is that a city that has a Sefer Torah, now you can be yotzei the mitzvot that are associated with that Sefer Torah. The hearing of the Kriyat Torah is something that you have a vested interest in. If the city no longer has a Sefer Torah, you're not going to hear laning. The city is not going to be able to do the mitzvah of Kriyat Torah. That does affect you, even if you have no monetary ownership in the Sefer Torah. For instance, you can own a Sefer Torah and lend it to the shul. Well, when you lend it to the shul, there are members of the shul who do not own that Sefer Torah, but they are still beneficiaries of the Sefer Torah, because they, mitzvah of Kriyat Torah, they benefit from when the Torah is read from, even though they don't own it. So if you have members of the city go and testify, or members of the city be judges here, they're still partial. They want the Sefer Torah to remain in the city, even if they don't own any of it. They want it to remain here, so they can do the mitzvah. That's why I mentioned before, the case here is likely when there's only one Sefer Torah. If there is a second Sefer in the Torah in the city, you could claim that they no longer have a vested interest, because they could be Yotzei with the other Sefer Torah, and therefore they may be actually independent now, or impartial because they relinquished their monetary control. They could be yotzei the mitzvah. There is another sefer Torah, and now they don't have a vested interest in this sefer Torah. Elim, can you argue that having two sefer Torah is beneficial to the city? They don't have to roll each time. I mean, there are things that you could come up with, but they're still getting benefit. But at a certain number of sefer Torah, they become impartial as long as they don't have ownership in the sefer Torah. So the Gemara says the sefer Torah is different than our case. So over there, even when you relinquish ownership, you still haven't relinquished your connection to the sefer Torah, your benefit that you derive from that sefer Torah. Very good. So Tosfot asks you a question, which is, if you were an owner at the time that the sefer Torah was stolen, how does it help that you relinquish your ownership now, which says that I have no vested interest in being returned? But the time that it was stolen, you were an owner of the sefer Torah. Doesn't that by definition make you partial or pasul? Look in the Bible, Tosfot, he says, later on in the Masechta, we're going to see tchilato v'sofo b'kashrut. You have to be impartial from beginning to end in the case. That means you have to be impartial at the time of the crime, and you have to be impartial at the time that you are adjudicating or testifying in the case. If you were problematic at the time of the crime, but now you're not problematic, you can't testify. For instance, you are a relative at the time that the crime went down. At this point, you're not a relative. Whether it's divorce, death, there are ways to have you no longer be connected to the case. We don't let you testify because you are a relative at the time that the crime went down. So your question is valid. Didn't he own something? How does his removal of ownership later, after the fact, help you out over here? Yes, he won't get any benefit from the solution to the case. But he was an owner when the crime took place. It's the equivalent of someone who was a relative and then was no longer a relative. That there's a difference between being nogea b'davar, that requirement that you be completely impartial or not related from beginning to end only deals with relationships. It only is a din in kirva, that you can't be a partial to the case because you are a relative. In the end, in the Gemara, we're going to see that it may not have anything to do with partiality. It's a gzeirat the katuv, that if you're a relative, you can't testify in the case. So there's a demand that you don't be a relative from beginning to end. In the case of monetary ownership, your relationship to the item all has to do with your ownership. And therefore, if you can remove your ownership, then in the end, that doesn't matter that you owned it originally. The fact that you don't own it now is enough to remove your partiality in the case and not to make it that you are pasul to the case. So Tosfot differentiates between a psul that derives from your relationship to the case, meaning that you are a relative of the parties or the judges or whoever it is in the case, and therefore it makes you pasul. There you need to be clean from beginning to end. Now then, when you're talking about monetary interest is only as good as the monetary interest. And if you can remove yourself from that monetary interest, we will no longer consider you to be pasul in this case. So therefore, your monetary ownership before won't hurt you now that you have removed yourself from the case or relinquished your ownership in the item in the Sefer Torah. That should have been sufficient to allow you to become kosher if it were not for the fact that you still have a vested interest in this Sefer Torah. Whereas Rimgash sees that as the question here. The question of the Gemara is not like the Rashbam says that there's Nunya Badavar, but rather what Tosafot is saying over here, that he was nogea b'davar at the time that the crime took place. And so therefore, how could he be testifying? How could he relinquish ownership now and that allow him to remain on the case? So Tosfot sees the solution as being a technical solution, which is the fact that this din of being kasher from beginning to end only applies by psulei kirva, psulim of krovim. But when it comes to monetary interests or vested interests, there's no requirement that you be completely independent from beginning to end. The Rimigash, following his position, says that originally when you had a monetary interest, you weren't an aid. You can't be a witness because of your monetary interest. You only turned into an aid after you removed that monetary interest. So you weren't pasul in the beginning and kasher in the end. You weren't an aid, and now you are an aid. So he again sees the difference as being not you were pasul, now kasher, but rather now you are an aid, whereas before you weren't an aid. It's somewhat similar to the answer that Tosafot is giving, whereas the Ramban sees the solution as being the same, which is just like by a relative, you can't testify about an incident that happened when your relative was involved. That's only if you were testifying for your relative or about your relative. But if you're testifying to third parties or about third parties in that same incident, then you are fine aid. And so too over here, when you are testifying now, you are testifying for other parties that have nothing to do with you. And so once you've separated the relationship between you and those other parties, you're allowed to testify. Just like a karov could testify in a case, as long as the kirva is not about what the testimony is about. And so too over here, your testimony now, once you've given up your monetary ownership, is for the other parties in the case. You're not testifying for yourself anymore. Yes, you're a pasul for yourself, but that doesn't make you pasul for the other parties. Just like a karov is pasul for his karov, but not for the other parties in the case. Tashma. Omer, tznumanet, the bnei yiri. Present in his last will and testament, or gifts to the city, money to be used for the infrastructure of the city, for the benefit of the city. Ein danim b'daniel oto ha'ir. You can't have judges from that city. Ve'im yivin rayam anshei oto ha'ir. And the people of that city can't be witnesses in the case. Again, because they have a vested interest monetarily in this gift being given to the city. The gift of the city is good for the budget of the city, either because whatever that he gave is now going to be used to improve the infrastructure and they're a beneficiary of that infrastructure improvement, or the gift now makes the burden on the members of the city lower, because his gift will pay and then they'll have to pay less to the taxes or the burden of the city. So am I, again, why? Again here, why don't you have some of them relinquish their rights to this money? In a sense, they will say, we're going to pay whatever the money was before, or the level of taxation before, independent of this gift. So we will not be beneficiaries of this gift whatsoever. In that case, they make themselves impartial to the case. It should work. So what are we saying again? It must be that we worry about collusion, and that relinquishing monetary control is not enough. It says, Achanami b'sefer Torah. The case here is also a sefer Torah. He gifted money to the city to purchase a sefer Torah. And that's why, again, you remain partial even if you remove your monetary ownership, because you're a beneficiary of the fact there is a Sefer Torah in this city. Tashma, Omer tznu manet l'aniyei iri. Someone says, give a gift to the poor people of my city. So he grants money, 100 zuz, to the poor of his city. Ein danim b'daniyei oto ha'ir, ein mivin rayam anshei oto ha'ir. Again, judges from that cannot be members of that city, and the witnesses can't be members of the city. All these cases are a case where someone's questioning whether the money really belongs to them, whether he really gifted it, and they're coming to testify that the money belongs to the city or belongs to the poor people of the city. It says, V'tizbra, aniim shakle, dayone mifsale? Well, how could it be that the aniim are beneficiaries, and now the judges are considered to be partial in the case? What is the connection between the judges and the aniim? There's no direct connection between them. The judges are not the recipients of the money. They're not the beneficiaries of the money. So why is it here that the judges are considered pasul when the aniim are the beneficiaries? Ela ema, ein danin b'daniyei aniyei oto ha'ir. Now you can't have the dayanim come from the poor people of that city, because now they become direct beneficiaries of the money. They are amongst the poor of the city. So someone who is of the poor of the city can't be a judge or can't be an aide in the case, because now they are the direct beneficiaries of the gift. Ve'ein mevi'in raya me'anei ota ha'ir. Va'amai, v'stalku be'trei nafshayu v'ledainu. Again, why can't they just relinquish their monetary rights? They will not accept the gift. They will not be amongst the beneficiaries of the gift to the ani of the city. And that should have been sufficient to get them out of the problem, based on what we're saying. So long as you relinquish your monetary rights, you should be off the hook. You should be fine to testify in the case or judge the case. It says, Achanami b'sefer Torah. Also over here, it's talking about a Sefer Torah. He donated a Sefer Torah to the city. Famai kari lehu anim. Why are they called poor people then? It sounds like he gifted the money to the poor people of the city. Why are you saying we're talking about a Sefer Torah? Ha'kol etzel Sefer Torah anim heim. Everybody's considered to be poor vis-a-vis a Sefer Torah. The way the Rashbam phrases it, it's a really nice thought. He says the following. Chukulam tzrichim lo. Everybody needs a Sefer Torah. B'derech b'nei adam likro b'nei yiro aniim, k'she'in lehem Sefer Torah. People call his fellow city mates poor when they don't have a Sefer Torah. D'aniyut gadol huzeh. That is an evidence of tremendous poverty. The first item that a city would put together or buy is a Sefer Torah. The fact that a city doesn't have a Sefer Torah is a very big indictment of that city. The only way a city is not going to buy a Sefer Torah is if they really don't have the funds to buy a Sefer Torah. That's telling you that you're talking about a city that is impoverished. Because otherwise, that would be the first thing that they do, is buy a Sefer Torah. So that's what it's saying. What does it mean he gifted money to the poor of the city? The poor of the city means this city that is poor, because they don't have a Sefer Torah. And again, now, even if you remove your monetary interest in the Sefer Torah, you have a vested interest in the city having a Sefer Torah, because you're going to be yotzei the mitzvah for them having a Sefer Torah, and that's the reason. It's not collusion that we're worried about. It's simply that your relinquishment of monetary ownership does nothing to solve the problem over here. You still have partiality in the city having a Sefer Torah. Vivai Dema, the other way to explain this, where there is partiality here is, Olam Kiditani, Aniim Mamash. They're literally the poor of the city. Ah, now you said before, why, if the poor people are the beneficiaries, why the judges then have to recuse themselves from the cases? Ubriyei deramu alayu. Because the members of the city are responsible to raise the funds to pay the aniim of the city. That means that you have a budget that has to be given to the aniim. Somebody gives a gift, the budget now is less. Now that you have to lay out less, each member of the city has to give less to the aniim. Vechidami, what's the case? If they have a fixed payment that they're going to make, by the kayitzlu. So if they have a fixed payment they were going to give, and now this donation reduces the fixed amount, let two of the members of the city pay the original fixed amount that they had set out or charged, because then they're not beneficiaries of this gift, because they are going to pay the full amount of the budget, assuming that the gift wasn't given. That they pay a fixed amount no matter what the needs of the aniim are. And therefore, there's no correlation between what's in the coffers or how much money is there and the fixed payment that they are making. So say that the budget was 200 zuz, and now each member of the city, there are 10 members of the city, each one was going to pay 20 zuz into the budget. Now this guy donates 100. That reduces the burden on each party in half. So now they all would have to give 10 instead of 20. Let two members still pay 20. That way they're not beneficiaries of the gift. Then they would not have to recuse themselves from the case. Achamayiskinan, the lo kayitzlu. It's a case where there's no fixed payment. The budget is determined on the fly, meaning depending on what the needs of the aniim are, you don't pay a fixed amount per year, you pay whatever the needs of the city are. In that case, then, when they divide up the how much each person owes, that amount will be reduced by the gift that's given. Or it says, Vibai Dema, Lolam Dekaitzlu. It's even in a case where you have a fixed payment per year that goes towards the budget of the city. Nevertheless, you can't relinquish your monetary ownership or benefit from this because Nechalu Dekaven Derabach Rabach. Because in an essence, it buys you time. Which is, say that you have a fixed payment that would go into the city. Now, the city needs to raise the money and put that money into its coffers to pay for the aniim or the budget of the aniim. When someone gifts the money, then even though you're going to still pay the same fixed amount, so I didn't get any monetary benefit from it because I'm going to stay pay the money that I would have paid before the gift was given. Yet you do have a benefit because the city will not charge you that money or demand the payment from you until they need it. And what's happened is his gift of 100 now postpones the necessity to collect that money. So basically, ravach, it gave you, bought you time. Because either the city will need the money later, or the city won't need the money at all, so they'll collect it when, even if you pay the money in, you only have to pay it later. So in essence, it gave you more window of time to pay the amount. So even though you're going to pay the same amount, you're still a beneficiary of the gift because you can pay it 6 months from now instead of paying it today. And so therefore you are a beneficiary. Given that, you can never get yourself out of having a monetary interest over here. Given that, you have to recuse yourself from the case and you can no longer be considered impartial. And that's why in all these cases, they cannot just relinquish monetary ownership. And there's a reason in each case why you can't do it. It's not because of collusion. It's not because we fear collusion. It's simply that there you have a residual vested interest even after your monetary ownership is removed from the situation. In our case, where you have completely indifferent in terms of the monetary ownership at this point, over there you are considered to be impartial and you could testify on behalf of the partner. Because no matter what the outcome is of the case, you're going to owe somebody money. And whether it's A's creditor or B, his partner who he gave the property to and with recourse, and now he's going to have to repay, we're indifferent between that outcome. And given that, you are considered to be impartial and you can testify in the case. And that's the case that Shmuel spoke about, Me'idim zelezet, that partners can testify on behalf of each other. It's interesting to note here that the Shulchan Aruch, in paskening about this issue, says he's following tshuvot of the other Rishonei Sfarad, like the Rivash and the Rashba, who say that it is a waiving of people's considered to be nogeba d'varu when it comes to matters of the city. Because in the end, the only people that are going to know about the matters of the city are members of the city. And therefore, they say it's almost an implicit agreement amongst the members of the city or parties in general that members of the city will be able to testify even though they are considered nogeya badavar, because otherwise we'll never solve or be able to deal with issues of the city. So it's as if they accept upon themselves these edim, or they accept arbitration in these cases despite the fact that these parties are not real edim or not real dayanim, because otherwise matters of the city would always become problematic. So it's interesting, despite the fact that there is this problem, they indicate that there's an implicit waiver of this problem in order to deal with issues of the city. Right now, Nasin Shomrei Sachar Zelezet. That's the next statement of Shmuel, that they are considered to be Shomrei Sachar. If one watches an item on behalf of the partnership, then that person is considered to be a Shomrei Sachar. If something goes wrong or it's stolen, he's going to have to repay the partnership for that. Just as a side note, of course, here we're talking about partners in Metaltalim, because we know that the dinim of shomrim don't apply to karka. They're excluded when it comes to karka. So therefore, obviously, we're talking about metaltalim, even if their partnership includes karka as well. The issue for the shomrei sachar over here is the issue of metaltalim that were stolen or taken from one of the two parties. The Gemara says, Amai, why should you be chayav? Shmira bibalim hi. It is the equivalent of entering into Shmirah when the Balim are, quote-unquote, present. We had this back in the Gemara Baba Metziah. We learned that the Torah speaks about it in the case of a Shoel, case of when you're borrowing an item. It says, Ubalavimo, if the owners are with him in this She'ilah, he's not responsible if something goes wrong with the She'ilah. The case, or the situation, is that a case where you lend an object to an individual, and that individual hires the owner to work with the item. So in that way, you have a relationship that is bilateral. You have a lender and a borrower, but the borrower is also the employer of the lender over here. So your relationship is going in two directions, which is you're both, in one case, the person is considered to be the owner, the employer. In the same moment, the borrower is also an employer because he's employing the owner of that item. That's called balavimo. If you have balavimo, then you're not chayav in the obligations of a shomer. Sometimes over here, if you have two shutafim that are watching on behalf of each other, the assumption of the Gemara now is that they're each watching different items of the partnership. That means that they both have engaged as owner shomer at the same time. That's the equivalent of balavimo. Balavimo, you don't pay as a shomer sachar. Now, the truth is that the parshia of balavimo is written by a shoel. If you remember in the Gemara in Baba Metziah, we said there was a vava chibur between the parshia of shomer sachar and parshia of shoel, and that vava chibur made the din of shoel apply to shomer sachar as well. Balavimo applies there. The question we had was by a shomer chinam. Does a shomer chinam also have a din of balavimo? And that would be dependent on what you think the obligations of a Shomer Chinam are, as well as whether you can move the din of Shoel all the way back to Shomer Chinam, which is two parashiyot before. But as far as a Shomer Sachar was concerned, everybody agreed that a Shomer Sachar has a din of Balavimo. So in this case, why would one of the two parties to the partnership be Chayav as a Shomer Sachar if they are Balavimo, that they are both engaged in Shmirah at the same time? You watch for me today, and I'll watch for you tomorrow. So they basically separated the Shmirah. It's not that there is simultaneous Shmirah. It's just that there is, you do it today, I do it tomorrow. Doing that already separates their two obligations to each other. You're going to be Shomer tomorrow because I'm Shomer today. That is the equivalent of a sachar, bartering of the shmirah between them, and you're deemed to be a shomer sachar. Both the Balei Tosafot and the Rashbam over here say, that's an explicit Mishnah. That's the Mishnah above Mitzvah, says that if you barter shmirah, you're considered to be shomrei sachar. What's the chiddush of Shmuel over here? It's an explicit Mishnah. So they both explain over here that this case is different because the Salka Datcha Amina the Shomer Chinamu. The Balav Chelik Chaveiro Yatzirich Lishmor Et Shelo. Because you were going to have to watch your property irrespective of the partner here. So maybe we'll reclassify you as a Shomer Chinam because basically all that's happening here is scale. I had to watch my property. While I'm watching my property, I'm just watching your property as well. If I didn't need to watch your property, I'd still have to watch my own property. So I'm already engaged in the process or the activity of watching, guarding my property. Then maybe when I guard your property, that's not considered to be a Shomer Sechar, they're considered to be a Shomer Chinam. Because all I'm doing is, as a side of bar of watching my own property, I'm also watching your property. I'm not doing anything more that I would have done otherwise. So maybe you would have been classified as a Shomer Chinam. Since I am a co-owner and everything that's here, maybe my watching of my quote-unquote chilek, my portion of it, by definition, I can watch your pair, even if it's a now an object or anything else, that watching or that is happening at the same time. I'm doing it anyway, because I have to do it for my portion of the 100%. What is your status now? What is your relationship to each other? Are you considered to be bartering the Shmirah? Which means that technically we both should have paid each other for the Shmirah, but we're waiving that payment because we're trading off the Shmirah. Or do I view it that, like you're saying maybe, that we are partners, and therefore we're going to work for each other for free because we are partners? Well, the Gemara answers is, in the end, you're bartering Shmirah. That's the nature of a partnership, which is, yes, you won't charge each other, but the reason you don't charge each other is because, in essence, I'm really charging you by having you do half the work, or have to take the responsibility another time. Those would ask over here, why does this necessarily solve the problem? That if you have an interaction by which you already verbally have agreed to do something for each other, that already makes you Shmira Bibalim. Because over there, when you guarantee or you say you're going to do something, you've obligated yourself immediately to do something or to carry out something. Over here, when you say, I'm going to watch it machar tomorrow, you do not obligate yourself today in anything. Your obligation only starts tomorrow. If there's some sort of relationship where you'll say, I'm going to borrow your animal and you're going to work for me. Now that's a demand that you work for me when your animal is here. You've already been mishabed yourself. You've already now entered yourself into a circumstance where you are obligated to work with the animal. It may not start right away, but in the case here where he says, you watch today, I watch tomorrow, the obligation of the one who says, I'm going to watch tomorrow does not start now. It only starts tomorrow. So separating that point of obligation makes it that the Amira can't create Shmira Bibalim. So there's a difference between whether your Amira obligates you immediately, and even though you won't carry out to a later date, or is your obligation only really start at a later date? And that's what Tosfot is saying is happening over here. And then again, he reiterates what we just saw in the Rashbam, that the Chiddush here is the fact that we don't consider you doing it gratis because of the fact you have to watch your stuff anyway. We consider it as if you're bartering that Shmirah and you are a Shomrei Sechar. Tarabanan. Machar lo bayit, machar lo sadeh, he sells him a house, sells him a field. He may not testify on the behalf of the buyer because he has recourse. The buyer has recourse against the seller. Machar lo para, machar lo talit. He sells him a cow, an ox, or he sells him a piece of clothing. Me'ilo ela. He can't testify about the fact that the buyer owns it. Because he does not have recourse. The buyer doesn't have recourse in that case. The Braita, that seems strange because what's the difference between the Reisha and the Seifa? That's what the Gemara says. Maishna Reisha, Maishna Seifa. What's the difference between the Reisha and the Seifa? Either you accepted responsibility and recourse, and therefore you're on the hook, whether it's Metaltalin or whether it's Karka, or the other way around. If you didn't accept recourse, then it shouldn't matter whether it's Karko or the Talit and Para, you are not considered to be no Geaba Dabar. Why should there be any difference between the material, the objects over here? Amar of Sheshet, Reisha. The case here is, it's going to become complex now, Beruvain Shegazal Sadeh Mishimon. Reuven stole the field from Shimon, Umochra Lelevi, and then he sold it to Levi. Ve'ata Yehuda, so now a totally independent party comes, and become Arer. He comes and says, the property was mine all along. It was taken from me, meaning that none of you guys have any ownership over here. Delo lezo Shimon the asid le Levi. Shimon may not go testify in behalf of Levi. The nechale, because it's to his benefit. The hadra, because he will then get the property back. What Shimon wants to establish is the fact that Levi really owns the property here. Because if Levi keeps the property, then Shimon can prove at some point that Reuven stole the property and sold it to Levi, and Shimon can get the property back. If it ends up in the hands of Yehuda, then he's going to have no way to get his property back. So he has a vested interest in seeing the property stay in Levi's hands rather than go to the hands of Yehuda. Now obviously Shimon doesn't have evidence of a deem to the fact that Reuven stole it, because if that was the case, then he wouldn't care. Then he could prove his ownership over here. But rather the case is the case where he has yet to bring evidence. He's complaining that Reuven stole it and sold it to Levi. And he's still considered no geir be'eduto, that he testifies to keep it in the hands of Levi, because he thinks in the future he'll be able to bring evidence to the fact that Reuven stole it from him. And that makes him a no geir be'davar. Gemara says, v'kevin dasi de Levi hu, heichi matzi mapik laminei. Wait a minute, if he comes and testifies on behalf of Levi and says, no, this property really belongs to Levi, then what right does he have to take it back in the end? If he comes along and says, Levi is the owner of the property, Shimon can't say that it was stolen from me and I'm going to take it back. He basically says it belongs to Levi. If it belongs to Levi, Shimon's not going to see that property anyway. Why is it considered to be a nogeya badover here? Because if he gives it to Levi, Shimon's not going to see it. Goes to Yehuda, Shimon's not going to see it. Why does it make a difference? Damar yadana dahai ara delav yuduahi. No, he doesn't testify that it belongs to Levi. He just testifies to the fact that it doesn't belong to Yehuda. So that can happen in different ways. There are different ways to establish the fact that it doesn't belong to Yehuda. The way the Rashbam states it over here is that he brings in witnesses that undermine the witnesses of Yehuda. Yehuda's witnesses that belong to him. He brings in witnesses to say they're gazlanim or they're psulei edut. So they don't have a right to testify on behalf of Yehuda. They're edim psulim. So in that way, he stops it from going to Yehuda. He doesn't make it Levi's. He doesn't give it to Levi. He doesn't announce that it's Levi's ownership, but rather he simply proves it's not Yehuda's ownership. So that's one way to have it happen. Another way, the Moreno Gershon simply says that he brings in edim to testify to the fact that it doesn't belong to Yehuda, which is very interesting, because that means that when you bring in witnesses or you testify the fact that it doesn't belong to so-and-so, you do not have to give who is or explain who the real owner is. You can have a demon come along and say, it didn't belong to Yehuda. Those edim don't have to tell us who did it belong to. They simply can tell us it didn't belong to Yehuda. So that's the question. How do you know that? They can come up with scenarios in which they know that it doesn't belong to Yehuda. They have some notions about where the property was, or that Yehuda was never here, never in this city. But that is a pretty amazing statement, that you can come into court and deny someone ownership without giving the true owner, without determining who the true owner is. Obviously, the Rashbam was uncomfortable with that, and therefore the Rashbam says the case is where they're posel de edim, because he doesn't want to have a case where you're testifying it doesn't belong to someone without giving us the true owner. And therefore, he comes up with a different way to deal with it. Tosfot does offer another alternative. He says the Gemara didn't answer this. But he could have asked, Avi Motz in the Shnuri, could go into Asid Shimon de Shalavutav de Levi Abba. All he has to do is get testimony to the fact that it belonged to Levi's parents, or family. And Levi inherited it. And then he bought it from Levi. Because then Shimon is not relinquishing his right to the property. He's saying, I own it because Levi sold it to me. And all he has to do now is prove that Levi's forefathers owned it. That will get Yehuda out of the picture. But he's getting Yehuda out of the picture without giving up his rights to the property. Tosfot offers another alternative. What the Gemara could have answered, even though the answer of the Gemara is simply that he's denying Yehuda's ownership and not verifying Levi's ownership. So Gemara says, "Ubaus chuta de kamapik la mi Levi, lepik mi Yehuda." Wait a minute. In the end, when he denies Yehuda owns it, that means that he's keeping it in the possession of Levi. Obviously, he doesn't care to keep it in the possession of Levi. He wants his property back. Shimon was the nigzal. He wants his property back. For some reason, he believes that if it's in Levi's hands, he can get it back. If it's in Yehuda's hands, he's not going to get it back. Well, whatever Raya, he must have some proof that Reuven stole it from him and sold it to Levi. Well, if he has that evidence, then why can't he bring that evidence to deny Yehuda's ownership? The same way that he's going to remove it from Levi's possession, he can remove it from Yehuda's possession. So why go through the trouble of moving it or denying Yehuda's ownership and giving it into Levi's hands? Just come with the same evidence that you're going to bring against Levi to keep the property and deny Yehuda his ownership that way. Why do you have to do this convoluted thing of keeping it in Levi's hands and then coming a second time and taking it away from Levi? Just take it away from Yehuda in the first place with that same evidence. Where it says, the Amar Asheni Noach Li Harishon Kasher Himenu. The difference is the party's difficulty in dealing with them. Over here, the Gemara is ambiguous as to who the Rishon and the Sheni is. Some suggest that that is intentional, because it doesn't really matter. That's what the Ramban says over here. We saw this Ramban also earlier in Bava Metzia as well, which is that when a person makes a claim that the second one is easier for me to adjudicate against than the first one, it's not literally that he has to prove that. It doesn't have to be that objectively that is the case. It either could be subjectively that's the case, or may not be the case at all. The fact that there is a possibility that he would rather have the property in Levi's hands than Yehuda's hands makes him a Nogeya Badavar. Why he wants it in Levi's hands, we have no idea. Even though he could bring the same proof and take it away from Yehuda, we don't know why he has that vested interest in it being in Levi's hands, but because we could explain why there may be a vested interest, which is in this case where it's easier for me to get it away from Levi than Yehuda. Yehuda is a strong man, he's politically connected, he won't listen to the courts. If Yehuda gets possession of the property, I'm not going to see it. If Levi has possession of the property, I can get it back from him. I can take him to court and I'll get it back. So there he has a vested interest in seeing the property move over to Levi. It makes him partial in the case, and therefore he can't testify on behalf of Levi. Again, whether that's true or not true just means that in a case like this, we won't allow you to testify because there could be this possibility. So that's one way to explain it, that this is simply a question about who it's easier to get the property from. Vibaitema. Shimon has witnesses that substantiate his case. Yehuda has witnesses that substantiate his case. Now, if you have witnesses on both sides, you have a stalemate. Once that happens, that wherever the property goes now, it's going to remain. Which means that Shimon has a vested interest in seeing that it doesn't land in Yehuda's hands. Because if it lands in Yehuda's hands, you're going to bring Edim. The Edim are going to be one set in favor of Shimon, one set in favor of Yehuda. Stalemate. We saw earlier in the Gemara, when you have Edut Mucheshet, Kodolim Gavar. The Beit Din takes themselves out of the picture, and then they work it out between them. The Mukzak in the property is going to be Yehuda. Yehuda is the Mukzak in the property. We're not going to move the property from Yehuda in your favor. It's going to stay with Yehuda until you can bring evidence to the contrary. On the other hand, if it ends up in Levi's hands, then your witnesses will trump in this case. Because now, if Levi owns the property, you come with your witnesses and you'll be able to take it away from Levi. That you wouldn't have been able to do with Yehuda. We're assuming that Levi doesn't have witnesses because it was stolen. And therefore, we're worried about the fact that he has a vested interest in seeing Levi be the owner of the property rather than Yehuda. If Yehuda's the owner of the property, he's not going to see the property. If Levi has the property, he will get the property back because the witnesses will favor his case. So Tosfot says, and he doesn't really understand what the Gemara's answer is over here, is because it's obvious that Shimon has Edim, and it's obvious Yehuda has Edim. Because if Shimon doesn't have Edim, he has no rights to the property, he's not going to get this property. If Yehuda doesn't have Edim here, Yehuda has no way to demonstrate ownership because all the other parties here, Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, all think they have claims to the property. So where is Yehuda coming along and saying it's my property? Without Edim, he's not going to have property. So Tosfot says, isn't it clear, even before the questioner came about and set up the case this way, isn't it obvious that Yehuda has witnesses and Shimon has witnesses? So what are you telling me? Oh, the case here is a case where they both have witnesses, and therefore it's a stalemate and he has a vested interest in seeing it in Levi's hands. What do you mean? That's the case. The case has to be that. Otherwise the case doesn't get off the ground. So that's what Tosfot asks. And therefore, what is the havamina of the questioner over here? That was the case to start with, and therefore it's obvious why he wants it in Levi's hands and not in Yehuda's hands. So he says, "Nir la Rashba, the Sakha Datcha, the Mikara Yehuda Baya Fuke mi Levi, Mishum Deitle Sade, Duvein Machar Lo, Ulu Levi, Ein Edim." Now, the questioner thought that the situation was a case where Yehuda has witnesses that Reuven sold it to him and not to Levi. Witnesses weren't that Yehuda was the true owner of the property, simply that he was the owner and not Levi with the owner. And Shimon's coming in with an interest to now make it Levi's ownership and not Yehuda. Questioner thought that the case of the scenario was Yehuda's witnesses were just coming to undermine Levi's position, not undermine Shimon's position. And in that case, why does Shimon have a vested interest in him being in Levi's hands versus Yehuda's hands? He could bring his edim and take it away from either party. What does he care? Well, his answer is no. Yehuda's witnesses aren't that he bought it from Reuven and not Levi, but rather Yehuda's witnesses are that he owned it from the start. Shimon has no ownership over here. That's a very different scenario, because then that clashes with Shimon's edim. If that's the case, Shimon has a very big vested interest in seeing the property in Levi's hands and not in Yehuda's hands. All right, we're actually in the middle of the sugya, but we're going to stop here because it continues along, starts to ask questions about this case, and then also has to explain the seifa. So far, we've only explained the ratio of the brayta that we brought. We have yet to explain how that relates to the seifa. So the Gemara is going to continue, but we'll stop here at the end of Mem Gimel Amud Bet.